It's 12:06.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This is the sound of renewed violence in the Middle East today. Rescue vehicles heading towards Jaffa Street in downtown Jerusalem. The bombing occurred within the hour, and joining us on the telephone from Jerusalem is Laura King from the Los Angeles Times. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
Well, first, fill us in. This was a bomb aboard a bus or adjacent to a bus?
Yes, aboard a bus during the middle of rush hour on one of the busiest streets in Jerusalem.
And tell us, do we know how many are dead, how many injured?
At the moment, it appears that there are 16 dead, at least 15 people seriously injured, and dozens more with lighter injuries.
Has anyone claimed responsibility?
There hasn't been a claim of responsibility, although everyone had been expecting that the group Hamas would be making some kind of retaliatory strike. The spiritual leader of Hamas was on television shortly after the explosion, expressing the view that that Israeli civilians could expect to suffer as long as the Israeli military occupation continued. But there has not been a formal claim of responsibility from Hamas or anyone else as yet.
We're hearing also that someone from Hamas, and maybe it was this person you're speaking of, said that the attack was a warning to Israelis that Palestinian fighters are capable of reaching them anywhere.
Yes, Sheikh Yassin said words to that effect, and that has been a theme for the past 24 hours or more since Israel carried out the attempted assassination of one of Hamas's top leaders, Adel Aziz Rantizi.
Yeah, this was the missile attack in Gaza. President Bush had condemned that attack on the part of the Israelis, saying that, in fact, it would jeopardize Israel security. And now it seems as if Israeli missile ships, helicopters, are attacking in Gaza. What do you know about that?
Well, it's hard to say whether it's linked in any way to this attack. It came very shortly afterward, and it could well have been something that was planned in advance. The Palestinians are saying that it appears there are 6 dead in that strike, which again involved missiles, and appeared to be some kind of a targeted strike. But it's very early to know what the situation is on the ground there.
Yeah, we've seen some pictures actually coming across showing in Gaza what appears to be almost a riotous reaction to the missiles.
Well, the mood there yesterday after the Rantisi incident was extremely, extremely angry, and I think that whatever action has taken place again today will only serve to inflame things.
Yeah, and Laura, we should say that CNN is now saying that Hamas has claimed responsibility for the bus bombing. This doesn't come as a surprise, I imagine.
No, it doesn't. They did make very specific threats yesterday that people were very much on guard here. And in fact, all the Israelis that I spoke to near the scene of the bombing today said we only wondered where it would be.
Mm. And by the way, Laura, as you said, it's right in the heart of Jerusalem.
Yes.
Can you give us a sense of what's happening there? How people are reacting?
Well, with a certain sense of stoicism, as tends to accompany these things, but shock nonetheless. I mean, people expect that it's going to happen somewhere, but then when it happens directly on their doorstep, they can't help but be shocked by it. But this stretch of Jaffa Street has been the scene of many, many attacks, although not in recent months, and most of the passersby and storekeepers said that they had been caught in more than one attack in that area, and that it had sort of a sense of deja vu about it.
Hmm. Well, Laura, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Laura King, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Well, today's attack would seem to fulfill the promise of revenge following yesterday's Israeli missile attack on Hamas co-founder Abdel Aziz Rantizi. And Hamas co-founder Rantizi, who narrowly escaped that attack on his car, vowed at the time from his hospital bed to continue his fight to destroy Israel. Who is Rantizi, and how much does he reflect the thinking of Palestinians? Charles Radin is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Tel Aviv. And Charles, you've met Rantizi more than once. Tell us about him.
Well, he's a very nice man, personally, who absolutely believes that Jews, and in that connection, the Judeo-Christian tradition, has nothing to do with this part of the world. And that the Jews should all be run out of here.
He's definitely a roadblock on the roadmap to peace.
Oh, I mean, he was in full defiance of the Prime Minister Abbas's attempts to get the roadmaps. He said, we're not going to stop our attacks. This is a sellout, and Abbas is a tool of the Zionists and the Americans, and had broken off ceasefire talks with Abbas. So he's a man with a very nice manner and a very hard line.
Well, Abdel Rantizi is a huge advocate of suicide bombings. We see another suicide bombing today. He's quoted as saying that you will not find a single Palestinian ready to compromise over land, and has also been quoted as saying that the Palestinians support the violence. What's your sense of that?
Well, it's completely untrue that you won't find a single Palestinian who supports compromise on land. Yeah, there are people walking the streets now who say this is not right, who said the, I don't know about today's bombing, but the attack on the Erez crossing in Gaza on Sunday. People who had just gotten their livelihoods back and now there was going to be a closure of the border again because of this attack. And they said they shouldn't do this.
We also have been hearing reports of, for instance, recently when Israeli tractors razed some buildings in a town in Gaza where suspected Hamas leaders were. We heard reports of farmers saying this is all Hamas's fault, and a blame seeming to shift on Hamas for inciting some of the actions of the Israelis. Is that a single voice, or do you think that, you're hearing more of that?
I think there's a little more of that because, see, you, for a long time you didn't hear anything like that because, you know, people are fond of using this word, the Palestinian street or the Arab street. And what people say in front of other people in the markets and, you know, the old-fashioned markets where kind of everyone knows everybody and is into everybody's business, that's a different level of public opinion than if you have friends or acquaintances in the middle class and professional levels of society and can talk to them. People have a long time been sort of intimidated to say on the street, Arafat is corrupt or Hamas is too violent or things like that, even people who think it. And now I would say they're becoming a little more willing to say that.
But on the other hand, we also see a suicide bombing a day after a Hamas leader is targeted, which would indicate, you know, that he still has his followers.
Absolutely. I mean, but this is one of the Israeli points, I think, whether anyone wants to accept it or not, is that when he said after Abbas appealed for the ceasefire, no. The Israelis say that's not just a political statement. That's telling his cells, the Hamas cells around the country, it's time for another round, guys.
Yeah. Well, Charlie Radin, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Charles Radin, correspondent for the Boston Globe in Tel Aviv.
From the Middle East's seemingly endless violence, now to Colombia and its seemingly endless civil war. Brutality rooted in the gulf between rich and poor, in murderous feuds between families, and, of course, because of the drug trade. The procession of atrocities, kidnappings, cruelty can become deadening, a kind of blur. But this is a story from Colombia that brings in sharp focus just how ravaged by inhumanity that country has become. It's the story of a 10-year-old boy named Erwin Orlando Ropero, a story told in the Los Angeles Times by T. Christian Miller, who joins us now on the line from the Colombian capital, Bogota. Welcome, T.
Thank you.
T, who was Erwin Orlando Ropero?
Bill, Erwin Orlando Ropero was a 10-year-old boy who lived in a tiny town called Fort Tule. He was an average, everyday, normal kid by everyone I've talked to, who was drawn into a military operation by Colombia's leftist guerrilla group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, as they're known by their Spanish initials. He met a teenager in the local town square there, and the teenager asked him if he would run an errand by delivering a bicycle, a mountain bike, a small, child-sized, purple-colored mountain bike, up to a military outpost on a highway crossing near the entrance to Fort Tule. The witnesses said that the teenager, who military officials later identified as a member of the guerrillas, offered to pay Erwin 35 cents for this task.
It's a lot of money for a 10-year-old boy in Colombia.
Yeah, 35 cents goes a long way for a kid whose family lives in a wooden shack at the end of a dirt road in a very, very poor, one of the poorest sections, actually, of Colombia. 35 cents to him would have been the chance to buy a pencil, to buy a notebook, to buy food for the family.
So he decided to do the errand, and he took the bicycle, and he was about 10 yards from a military checkpoint and in front of a kind of food stand, wasn't he? And then what happened?
He approaches the military checkpoint, and suddenly there's this huge explosion. As it turns out, the trick the FARC had played was they had loaded dynamite into the center tube of the bicycle and actually turned it into a bomb. And I saw photos of the boy, Bill, after the incident that were taken by the police. And those were the photos that sort of moved me to write a story just about him and about his biography, because to see a little 10-year-old boy, just his torso and just part of his face left looking up at the sky, that's a horrible thing.
A little bit later, you write, and write so eloquently, a procession through this town. I want to ask you to read from your article about that procession.
Sure, thanks very much. Irwin's 3-foot white coffin, the cheapest the mortuary had, was loaded into a small brown station wagon that served as the town's hearse. The congregation marched slowly behind it toward the cemetery. In their hands, they carried white flags as symbols of peace. As they walked through town, residents recall, a surprising thing happened. More and more people came out of their homes to join the march. Even soldiers and police joined in, holding white flags inscribed with the word peace, along with their guns. By the time the procession reached the cemetery, it had swelled from 50 people to more than 300, walking in almost complete silence. Just outside the entrance, the town's priest stopped the hearse. He had the children come forward, nearly 100 of them. The oldest lifted Irwin's coffin out of the car. Procession moved forward again, a small white box bobbing above a sea of children.
T, 2,000 children die violently in Colombia each year. Why does it seem that Irwin's story has broken through that awful kind of deadening, that emotional blur that we mentioned in our introduction?
Most 2,000 kids who die in this conflict each year are caught in crossfires or accidental deaths, which are terrible, but they're accidental. In Irwin's case, somebody had to sit with a button from about 50 yards away and watch a 10-year-old boy ride a bicycle and kill him. And to me, that is a sign that the conflict has passed all sorts of limits, when you can intentionally kill a 10-year-old child.
T. Christian Miller, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it.
T. Christian Miller is Bogota Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cambridge School of Culinary Arts, providing accredited culinary training for enthusiasts and professionals for more than 25 years. More at cambridgeculinary.com. And North Shore Magnetic Imaging Center, providing MRI services for over 15 years. Locations in Peabody, Beverly, and Salem. Information at 800-540-8960.
Click and Clack have something special for your dad this Father's Day, an original Car Talk tie.
From a distance, it looks like a standard issue striped silk business wear tie. But when you get up close, you see that the stripes are actually made up of all the names in our credits.
That's right, like our staff dietitian, Diana Hunger.
Order a Car Talk tie for your dad by calling 800-909-9287 or online at WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A lot of people, when they've got a good thing going, are mostly interested in keeping that good thing going. Let's say, for example, you've won the Pulitzer Prize for your last play. The high point of an already spectacularly successful career in the theater, for your next act, so to speak, you write another play, right? Well, not if you're the playwright in question here, Susan Laurie Parks. She's gone and written her first novel, branching out, some might say sticking her neck out, into fiction. The new book's called Getting Mother's Body, and Susan Laurie Parks joins us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome, Susan Laurie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here.
So, Susan Laurie Parks, you go ahead and you win the Pulitzer Prize for a play, Top Dog, Underdog. It so happens, I have learned, that you finished your first novel the day you won the Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah, two days before.
So
set the record straight.
Why did you decide to write a novel when you'd had this play that was such a success?
You know, before I was a playwright, I was a short story writer. And when I took a creative writing class with James Baldwin, he was the one who suggested that I might try writing for the theater.
James Baldwin,
the great and wonderful James Baldwin.
Well, boy, there's a suggestion from Mount Olympus for a young writer.
Yeah. So ordinarily, I guess if it had been another teacher, I would have gone, no, I haven't thought about it.
Well, you know.
Right, exactly.
Well, this book is about Billy Beade, and she's the daughter of Willa May, who's been dead for 6 years.
Yes.
Although she's quite a character in the book.
Yeah.
Tell me about Billy Beade and her search for her mother's grave in La Junta, Arizona.
La Junta. Billy is 16 years old. She's pregnant. She doesn't have a husband. And she lives with her aunt and uncle, and they run a gas station. They don't own it. They just pump the gas.
Right.
And they have very little money. So they decide to go to La Junta, where her mother is buried, and dig up her mother because her mother's buried with a diamond ring and a pearl necklace, and that could bring a lot of money.
How do you know about these characters?
Characters to me come to me in a weird kind of way. It's not people I know. It's never the stuff of memoir or biography, autobiography. It's always sort of voices that I hear sort of actually I'm pointing right now to back left.
Characters coming from the back left behind you. You mean that literally. You're not just talking symbolically.
I'm pointing.
The voices.
Yeah. You know, in the old days.
They're floating in from somewhere.
Well, in the olden days, they used to say, you know, saints had visions because of moldy bread, you know. Maybe I ate some moldy bread.
Now, Susan Laurie, although James Baldwin first inspired you to write plays rather than fiction, fact is, this is a book full of monologues. It's not narrative. It's not descriptive unless the character is being descriptive.
Well, it's always people's voices. But it is narrative in the way that someone can tell you a story. If you could imagine it, like it's like a film in which the character continually turns toward the camera and speaks directly to the viewer. The character is aware of the viewer. The character is aware of the reader. The character wants to get their bit in.
Let's hear one of the voices from the book, and let's hear that voice speaking about something called the whole.
Okay, this is Willa May Beade's chapter.
She's the mother of the main character, Billy Beade.
Yes, the dead mother.
The dead mother.
Everybody's got a hole. Just don't everybody got one in the same place. Some got a hole in the head. Now, you may think hole in the head is just another way of saying stupid, but hole in the head means more than that. It means that they got a lack and a craving for knowledge. Not just the lack now, but the craving too. A man could have a hole just about anywheres. In the head, in the wallet, which means he burns his money, in the pocket, which means he don't got no money to burn but would like some, in the pants, in the guts, in the stomach, in the heart. You offer a person with a hole in the head some knowledge, and they gonna be in your pocket, 'cause you done give him the opportunity to taste what he craves. But if a person's got a hole in their heart, and you offer them knowledge, you won't be able to sway them none. A hole in the heart person craves company and kindness, not no book.
You really can see that character standing on a stage or facing a camera, I must admit.
She's lying, but she's actually in the novel, she is lying 6 feet under the earth in Arizona.
This is true.
Speaking to you.
Yeah. She not only speaks Willa May Beade, but she sings, too.
She sings.
From beyond the grave.
Yes, Willa May does sing. Willa May, when she was living, was a troublesome, beautiful, troublesome, no-count, trifling woman who is also an aspiring blues singer. And in her death, she continues to sing.
Why don't you sing
okay,
us one?
Okay, I'll sing one. It goes like this. It's called, this one's called Digging Ditches by the Road. I've been in jail from Abilene way down to Galveston. I've seen the Gulf of Mexico through the jailhouse wall. I wore my chain gang stripes digging ditches by the road. But I swear to you, I never did much wrong.
Willa Mae Bead, sung by the person who created her, Susan Laurie Parks. How much of a burden has it been for you, or not a burden at all, spotlighted as a rising star? Mel Gussow, the New York Times, called you the most promising playwright in the country around 1989. You're about 26. Your name's often put together with people like Alice Walker and Toni Morrison and Zora Neale Hurston. Mm-hmm. How does that affect you?
Well, I really believe it's how you take it. You know, I think praise can be helpful. It can also be very damaging. It depends really on how you take it. A good review is as damaging sometimes as a bad review. Especially in the past year since winning the Pulitzer, I've worked harder in the past year than I've ever worked. because I'm more committed to my own, you know, quality of work than I've ever been. So,
well, it's a wonderful book, Getting Mother's Body, Susan Laurie Parks. Thanks so much for coming in and joining us on Here and Now today.
Thanks for having me. It's fun.
Susan Laurie Parks is author of the new book, Getting Mother's Body. Who said?
More ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Landry and Arcari Oriental Rugs and Carpeting, offering a complimentary brochure filled with pictures and tips on buying rugs and carpeting. 800-649-5909. Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events. 617-261-6060. And The Catered Affair, since 1979, creating chef-inspired cuisine for intimate dinner parties to festive galas. In Greater New England, information on the web at thecateredaffair.com. The WBUR online auction is underway. It's your chance to bid on hundreds of items, including a private performance by humorist Jimmy Tingle and a reproduction of Schwen's 1939 Black Phantom bicycle from Castor's Bicycles and Fitness. Go to WBUR.org and make a bid for the news.
I'm Bill Littlefield. A tradition there was that's been absent of late. It's returned to us thanks to a kind twist of fate. The Brewer's Offering is back, and I'm pleased to announce you can come sample wonderful brews by the ounce, plus games and prizes and food for your plate. Now, you won't want to miss this, so write down the date. It's happening Saturday, June 21st. Bring your appetite, friends, and a moderate thirst.
For your tickets to the Brewer's Offering and Food Expo, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, discovery of a murdered teen fuels the push for DNA legislation.
And the courts in Ontario, Canada, say gay couples can get married.
It's an acknowledgement of equal respect and dignity to the relationships of gay and lesbian couples.
Also, Car Talk's Ray Maliazzi makes red lobster sauce just like Grandma used to.
This is my grandmother's recipe, so this is a recipe from my childhood. And when we were growing up, Grandma lived with us. And my mother deferred to her when it came to the cooking because whatever my mother did was wrong.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
Good afternoon, I'm Dolores Handy. There have been two deadly attacks in the Middle East today. Israeli helicopters fired missiles at Gaza City, killing at least seven people, including two senior Hamas leaders. This just an hour after a suicide attack on a bus in Jerusalem that killed as many as 15 people. Associated Press correspondent Mark Levy is there.
A suicide bomber blew himself up on a city bus in downtown Jerusalem. The Israel Radio is reporting several were killed. The scene of the bomb is pretty much pandemonium. Police are racing in, ambulances racing back and forth, rescue workers dealing with the wounded, and police trying to keep people away. Almost a typical scene of a suicide bombing attack. There have been almost 100 of them, and Israel's kind of getting used to this. Certainly there were those who were saying that the assassination attempt would set off a wave of counterstrikes. Others, however, including the government, by the way, believe that Hamas and the other militant groups carry out these attacks whenever they can.
Yesterday's attack in Gaza wounded a commander of the military wing of Hamas. Democrats on Capitol Hill are pressing for evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, the reason the Bush administration asserted was the reason for war. The Senate Intelligence Committee plans to hold closed-door hearings to assess intelligence reports on the matter. Committee Chairman Republican Pat Roberts says he's concerned about allegations that agents were pressured to exaggerate reports of Iraqi weapons programs.
If any officials believe, however, that they have been pressured to alter their assessment, they have an obligation, and I encourage them to contact the committee. We will keep such matters confidential.
Some Democrats say they wonder if claims of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction were true, since none has been found so far. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is accusing U.S. officials of mounting a smear campaign against him. Blix tells England's Guardian newspaper that officials pressured him to include more damning evidence in his reports on Iraq's alleged weapons program and planted stories about him in the news media. More than 3,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed in the U.S.-led war in that country. The number will likely climb. This according to a survey conducted by the Associated Press. The count, based on records from about half of Iraq's hospitals, finds 3,240 civilians were killed between March 20th and April 30th. You're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Mercury Computer Systems, producing high-performance stream computing solutions for today's image and signal processing challenges, www.mc.com. Skinner Auctioneers, currently accepting furniture, paintings, jewelry, and other antiques for this summer and fall auction seasons. Auction schedule online at skinnerinc.com. And Mississippi's. Mississippi's delivers from 7 in the morning till 6 in the evening, 6 days a week. In sports, the Red Sox and Cardinals play the second game of their three-game interleague series at Fenway tonight. Pedro Martinez returns to the mound for the Sox tonight. This is his first start in nearly a month. He's been on the disabled list with a muscle strain. The NBA Finals, the San Antonio Spurs and New Jersey Nets play game 4 tonight in New Jersey. The Spurs lead the best of 7 series 2-1. Thunderstorms in the forecast for this afternoon, highs in the upper 70s to near 80. It's 73 degrees in Boston at 12:34.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The family of Molly Bish, the 16-year-old lifeguard from the small town of Warren, Massachusetts, whose remains were identified Monday after a 3-year search, is pleading for their daughter's killer to turn himself in. The case has brought a wave of support and empathy from people around the world, and it's also prompting action in the Massachusetts legislature. Tomorrow, the state Senate will debate a bill requiring mandatory DNA testing of anyone convicted of a felony in the state. Well, joining us on the line is Massachusetts Senator Cheryl Jakes. She's one of the sponsors of the DNA bill. And Senator Jakes, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, happy to.
And on a pretty sad day, tell us why you pushed for this testing bill and why, in fact, the Bish family has been pushing for it.
The Bish family, much to their credit, said, gee, how do we get involved? What more can we do to protect others? And what this bill would do is Massachusetts would join 27 other states in expanding our current DNA database testing, which is only limited currently to sex offenders and violent felons, to all felons, embezzlers, forgers, stalkers, you name it. We don't test those people right now, but we will once this law changes. The more people you test, the more likely you are to get an investigative lead from a crime scene, the more likely you are to convict a suspect with solid forensic evidence.
Do you think testing can prevent the kind of crime that we're now witnessing with Molly Bish?
It certainly has a deterrent value because criminals are not stupid, and they will know that once they are in that DNA database, if they leave so much as a hair behind, a single fiber of hair behind at a crime scene, You know, they can run, but they won't be able to hide because we will be able to track them down and find them.
Well, we just heard of a case in New Orleans where, in fact, they had a huge roundup of 1,000 people giving DNA. But, in fact, the information, the DNA information, came from another township which wasn't even coordinated with the roundup.
Well, not only will Massachusetts benefit because we'll have a more expanded pool to search from, but when we do cross-checks with the FBI's database, you know, we may solve a crime in another state. I mean, ultimately, we will have a national DNA database so that the borders won't be a protection for criminals.
Mm. What about the questions of privacy concerns?
There are very strict penalties for calling up the information for non-investigative purposes. There are criminal and prison penalties if you disseminate the information. And also, the genetic markers that are used are solely good for identification purposes. They can only tell us that it's Robin Young. They can't tell us anything about your medical history, your predisposition to cancer, or any other sort of genetic profiling. So they're very, very limited in the scope of the information that they disclose.
Mm. Back to the Molly Bish story. This is a story that has racked her town and the family. And a close friend of Molly's was killed last night in a car accident. A young man who was said to be distraught over the discovery might have been a factor in his accident. With all of this going on, how have you seen the Bish family responding?
You know, the Bish family are just remarkable people, and I believe it's their faith that gives them such strength. And just to give you an example of that, they had offered to be helpful with the press conference that was set up weeks ago.
You mean for the DNA legislation?
Correct. The day before the press conference, Molly, one of the first bones was discovered, which everyone was worried was Molly, but it wasn't confirmed. So we just assumed that press conference was canceled. John Bish was on the phone calling, saying, absolutely not. Now more than ever, we're going forward. There's no time for tears. There's no time for, you know, self-pity. We got to get out there. We got to get this law passed. We've got to give the district attorneys and the law enforcement community the tools they need to, you know, identify these perpetrators and put them behind bars. It was just remarkable, remarkable strength at such a difficult time.
Senator Cheryl Jakes, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Massachusetts Senator Cheryl Jakes.
For the first time anywhere in the world except the Netherlands, Belgium, and Denmark, gay couples can now receive marriage licenses in Ontario, Canada's most populous province. The piece of paper gays will get will differ in no detail from what non-gay couples get, since an Ontario appeals court yesterday declared restrictions against same-sex marriage are in violation of Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Well, joining us to discuss the ruling is Joanna Radbord, a Toronto attorney who represented some of the couples who challenged Canada's former definition of marriage as limited to one man and one woman. Welcome, Joanna.
Thanks.
Joanna, first of all, this sort of thing's been very controversial down here in the States. Do you expect a legal challenge?
Actually, I'm expecting that the government will be pleased that the responsibility has been lifted from its shoulders, and now it can say that the courts made the government do it and not take on political responsibility for its actions.
So you expect this to be the law now and no serious challenges to it?
That's what I'm hoping. There have been marriages now between couples of the same sex in Ontario, so the genie's out of the bottle. It wouldn't make any sense to appeal.
There have been marriages already, even before this appeals court ruled?
Well, there were two marriages by publication of banns, which is an ancient Anglican ritual that lets you avoid the requirement of a license, that happened back in January of 2001. The court recognized that those marriages are valid, and so there's those two legal marriages. As well, as soon as the decision was released yesterday, couples went down to City Hall, received their marriage licenses, and had wedding ceremonies.
Now, Joanna, what difference does it all make? It's just a piece of paper.
It's so much more than a piece of paper. Marriage is such a valued social, cultural ritual in our society, and it's a stamp of social approval. It's an acknowledgement of equal respect and dignity to the relationships of gay and lesbian couples.
Just to be crystal clear, this marriage license, what does it confer on a gay couple that they didn't have before? What rights?
list. There are some important ones at the provincial level. Here in Ontario, if you die without a will, ordinarily there are special protections for a married spouse. If you don't have a married spouse, it can go to the state before it goes to your same-sex partner or your unmarried opposite-sex partner. So that's the kind of thing that will change. But there are very few of those exceptional forms of treatment that are reserved exclusively for married.
Do you expect this to extend, I'll ask you first, to other places in Canada? And what impact do you think it might have down here in the United States? First, Canada.
In Canada, hopefully other provinces, although they're not bound by an Ontario ruling, will comply with the ruling. Failing that, the government has already indicated that it wants equality across Canada. So I would expect legislation to be passed shortly that recognizes that same-sex couples ought to be free to marry in every province.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the U.S.? Is there any talk up there about extending this down here?
Well, I know there's been a tremendous amount of litigation already in the United States. You know, in Vermont, there are now civil unions, which is a second-class status rather than full and equal marriage. But the litigation continues, and hopefully now this is an excellent precedent from your neighbors to the north that will inspire American judges and provide equality to their citizens.
Joanna, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joanna. Joanna Radbord, an Ontario attorney. She joined us from her office in Toronto.
Still to come, he fixes cars and he cooks. Car Talk's Ray leaves Tom in the Good News Garage and heads into the kitchen.
More coming up on Here and Now. As the school year draws to a close, one school in Portland, Oregon, is feeling the effect of the No Child Left Behind Act signed into law by President Bush last year. Academic achievement at the Marshall High School in Portland, Oregon, is below state standards, and that means under the new law, children can transfer out of the school to better performing ones. And they're leaving Marshall High in droves. Well, joining us on the line now from Portland is John Wilhelmy, who's principal of Marshall High School. Hello, John.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. John, what kind of numbers are we talking about leaving Marshall High School?
From a couple months ago, last time I checked with our district transfer office, we had 111, as appears in the article.
Out of how many students?
That's unclear. It's roughly maybe a third of our incoming freshmen. We're talking about our incoming freshmen right here.
Yeah.
These are students who have yet to set foot into the building.
Now, John, you're a man who's devoted your life to educating kids. What's not good about kids trying to get a better education at a better school?
The question here is when we say at a better school. We are, yes, considered a low-achieving school, but I've got conclusive data that says our kids are achieving equal to the students in the city's premier highest-achieving school. In terms of percentage point gain on the statewide assessment. The rate of academic growth is identical. We need to factor in to the equation exactly the academic growth that is happening. Hmm. And right now, the law ignores that, and we lose kids because of it. It promotes the perception that learning is not happening at my school, and that's where I take issue. Learning is happening at this school.
You're going to lose as much as a third of your incoming ninth graders will never even set foot in the school. What does that mean for Marshall?
Well, here's what that means. For every 30 students that choose not to come into Marshall, we will lose a teacher. When you lose a teacher, you lose the program that's associated with that teacher. You lose kids, you lose a teacher, you lose a teacher, you lose the programs, and then you have less to offer. So what's the draw? What are we going to put on our marquee for kids to come to Marshall?
So, John, here you've got kids, many from difficult and impoverished backgrounds. They are making progress, yet they see many other kids electing not to go to their school. What does that do to morale at a place like Marshall?
Well, it doesn't help morale at all. It doesn't help the morale of the students who choose to go here. It doesn't help the morale of the teachers who are here. It doesn't help the morale of the administration. It doesn't help the morale of the parents of the students who go here. It just doesn't help the morale of the community. We're trying to counter that with as many progressive measures as we can. And, you know, this is what No Child Left Behind is intending to do. However, I would counter that I would, as a new principal, have intended to do that anyway, regardless. The idea of all of this is just to maybe tweak this thing so it works for us rather than, in this case, maybe ultimately closing us down. Who knows? I'd hate to see that happen.
John, you sound like a very dedicated principal. They're lucky to have you at Marshall High. Thank you for joining us on
Here Now. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Nice talking with you today.
Nice talking to you. John Wilhelmy is principal of Marshall High School in Portland, Oregon.
There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Murta Kalina, LLP, a law firm with offices in Boston, Woburn, Hartford, and New Haven, serving the legal needs of businesses and individuals throughout New England on the web at murtalaw.com. By Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, serving homestyle Persian cuisine for lunch Monday through Friday and dinner nightly. Private rooms available. Reservations at 617-720-5511. And Afinia Dumont, an executive fitness suite hotel in New York, where healthy meets high tech. Information at afinia.com. AFFINIA.com. Do something special for your dad on Father's Day by ordering a silk Car Talk tie from WBUR. See the tie up close and make your contribution on the web at WBUR.org. It's 1248.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and I've moved into the kitchen where every other week our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, comes in and prepares a meal. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Robin.
And Kathy, you've made a great observation that while you're here in the kitchen, right over there in the cafeteria, people here at WBUR in Boston are having their lunch, and that includes the staff of NPR's Car Talk, which is really one big long meal during which a radio program occasionally breaks out.
And a lot of laughing. That's all I hear out there is these guys having the best time. And I get jealous.
Well, apparently, though, one in particular comes in. He's Ray Maliazzi, and you had this thought.
Well, he's always coming in and telling me these great old family recipes. So I'm like, okay, put your money where your mouth is. Why don't you come cook with me? So here he is, our guest chef today.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
See, how many times around here do people tell you, put your money where your mouth is, big guy?
Not often. I'm ready, though.
Yeah, you are, and that's because you come from a family who cooks?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, how would you get to look like this otherwise? Right?
tell us about this recipe, because you described this to me, that you stuff lobster bodies and you simmer them in a tomato sauce, and it all gets thrown on pasta, and it made me crazy. It just sounds so fabulous. So whose recipe is this?
Oh, this is my grandmother's recipe. So this is a recipe from my childhood. And when we were growing up, Grandma lived with us. She was a widow, and my mother deferred to her when it came to the cooking because whatever my mother did was wrong. So Grandma always, you know.
Where did she grow up?
Oh, Grandma?
Yeah.
Grandma grew up in Italy, in Gaeta, a little town on the coast. And she brought with her a bunch of interesting recipes. Not interesting, but they were all basic in that they used the primary ingredients, which are essential to the Italian diet.
Which are?
Olive oil and garlic.
Yeah.
And I've realized over the years that I do love those two ingredients. And everything I cook, at least Italian-wise, is just an excuse to load up on those ingredients. And I don't measure anything. Everything's done by feel. Everything's done. Well, that's the way my grandmother cooked, and I will let how much garlic I think I need that time determine how much I put in.
That's as is the case good cooks.
With olive oil, too. And if it, you know, if the stuffing, we're going to make a stuffing here, basically a breadcrumb stuffing.
Okay,
we're making
how do
a breadcrumb stuffing.
Lobster body?
Well, we're going to stuff it, but we're gonna, let's make a bowl in which we can make the stuffing.
Okay. We've got a bowl. What do you want me to do?
Well, we've got about half a dozen lobster heads.
Yep.
So we're probably going to use about 2 cups of breadcrumbs. And we're using Progresso Italian seasoned breadcrumbs. That looks like about two cups. Yeah, a little more maybe.
Okay.
That's perfect.
All right.
Is this how you work on cars? You have a little oil,
no,
maybe?
No, no. In fact, when you work on cars, you have to be rather precise. So this is an opportunity for me to kind of wing it.
Believe it or not, it works with cooking sometimes, too. Okay?
If you're making a cake, you have to be precise.
That's
but
right.
You don't have to be precise
not
for this stuff.
Okay, 2 cups of flavored breadcrumbs.
Right, and now whatever garlic you chopped up,
okay,
we'll just throw that in.
Probably 3 or 4 cloves, and you can use less or more.
Frequently, I feel like more garlic, so I'll throw in an extra clove or two. But if you're not a garlic lover, then forget it. And
okay.
We're going to throw in some black olives.
Do I chop them or leave them?
I would chop them.
Okay.
Coarsely chop.
We've got Greek olives or Italian olives.
Yeah, I use the California, the big...
All right. So this is about a cup and a half of coarsely chopped pitted black olives.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to use them all. Now that I'm looking at them.
Too
so,
much?
Yeah, we'll probably use about half of the amount. So maybe 3/4 of a cup.
All right.
And then there are 2 essential ingredients here, and you have
I
to
feel
decide.
The olive oil coming on.
Yeah, the olive oil and the crushed crushed red pepper.
Got it. All right. How much crushed red pepper?
That's a tough call. Go ahead.
More?
That's a lot.
This is Diavolo, exactly.
What's that?
The devil. You know?
Yeah. Hot, you know, a red sauce with chili pepper, they always refer to the devil.
Sometimes I will make these, and they're so hot that I'm the only one who can eat them in the household.
No, this should be okay.
Oh.
That's funny how that works out.
There's a method to your method. So we've got 2 cups of breadcrumbs, about a cup of chopped olives, and about 3 cloves of chopped garlic. How much olive oil?
Well, start adding.
Here we go.
And we're going to mix it the same. I'll mix.
Okay, great. So far we've got almost half a cup there. You just want to moisten it up?
I want to moisten it up, exactly.
Okay, so it should all come together.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And you may even want to mix it with your hands, you know, because you have to get the feel
like
for it.
Like a meatball. I'll do that. I'm not shy about that. Okay, my hands are gooey here. I've got the breadcrumb mixture.
Now we're gonna stuff the heads.
Yeah,
now these are all cooked.
There.
No, I don't
these
crack
totally
them.
Cooked.
No, and they're completely empty inside because they've taken out everything. And you're going to stuff them with the stuffing.
Okay, let's explain that. So the lobster body kind of has a hole in the side of it. It's like a hollow opening.
Yeah.
A cavity.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's a good food word.
Where the tail's been removed.
Exactly. So I'm going to shove this breadcrumb stuffing in. That's a good food word, huh? Shove.
Yeah.
And just push it in. You want to get as much as you can in there?
Exactly.
Oh,
you don't want to pack it in so tightly that the sauce can't penetrate. Because what you're hoping is that, don't forget, these are already cooked. When my grandmother used to make these, the few times that we could afford to get the whole lobster, she would, of course, the lobsters not only were whole, but they were live. She would stab a hole in the top of the head and remove everything from the top of the head, all the undesirable parts of the lobster.
Sure.
Remove that stuff.
Of course,
by that time, the lobster was dead. And she would stuff it from the top. And then the entire lobster would go and sit in the sauce and simmer for a period of several hours.
So once I stuff it, do I put it in the sauce?
Yeah, you throw it in the sauce.
Okay, and we should also say that we've got about 6 cups of tomato sauce here, and you want to use your best tomato sauce.
Okay, I have a question,
right,
you two.
Putting it into the pot.
Why won't it come out, though?
Well, some of it will come out for sure, but if you stuff it in, I don't know, it has a certain...
Well, it's kind of dense. I could see it's staying in there, and of course, if it comes out, what's coming out? Garlic and olives, yum.
So it's going in the sauce.
It's going to flavor the sauce.
It can't hurt anything, and I'm not sure my grandmother didn't use some Portland cement in the mixture, but you know.
Where's the meat, the lobster meat in this anymore?
Well, when you open the body, if you tear the body apart, if you Kathy will show you, her hands are already dirty.
Yeah, I'm already glued up. I mean, look at that. It's just filled with beautiful roe, and there's meat here, the tamale, which some people love and others hate.
Okay.
This is a great 50-cent snack.
So you just tore the body apart and...
Can suck these claws. Yeah. There's tons of meat in
What's
there.
Left behind when you buy these, they've removed the 2 large claws, but all the little claws are still attached, and the part of the body that they're attached to is all loaded with meat.
You just have to rip and suck.
Yeah.
All righty.
That's my technique.
It's a little bit of a chore.
So, Ray, while she's completing filling these lobster bodies, does Tom cook, too? Why do I already think I know the answer to that?
He cooks a little bit, but mostly Joanne tries to keep him out of the kitchen. he can be dangerous.
I just want to interrupt you for a second. We've got 8 lobster bodies stuffed here. Can I kind of push them into the sauce?
Yeah, you'll probably have one, two. No, as long as they're all covered, that's perfect.
Okay.
And because they're already cooked, and I would cover it and come back next week.
Next week, no problem. All right. In the meantime, we'll go to car talk, and then we'll come. No. So how long really do I want this to cook?
Well,
in a simmer, low simmer?
Oh, yeah, as low as you can get, and okay. Usually a couple of hours.
I've got all the time in the world here, right? So we're going to boil some water for pasta for when our sauce is ready.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do, just throw the whole thing on top of this big plate?
Yeah, we usually, after we've drained the water from the pasta, the entire contents of this pot with the lobsters and the sauce goes right on the top.
I'm sure it'll be no problem if we pop up during All Things Considered.
So let's give it a little while, and we'll come back and cook our pasta and finish off Ray's lobster body pasta sauce. We're back. This kitchen smells like coastal Italy. I mean, I can just imagine your grandmother with the pot simmering. The tomato sauce is thickened. Of course, the lobster bodies were red to begin with, but the breadcrumb is nice and firm, and just a lot of garlic, a lot of tomatoes, and the wonderful smell of lobster. Why don't we all give it a taste?
Okay, you first.
Okay. Yeah, because see, Kathy, here's the thing. I think he made the whole thing up. So I'm going to...
Now, of course, it was my tomato sauce at
the
base.
Well, absolutely.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Get some of the bread.
I love the way the lobster flavor has scented the tomato sauce without completely taking over.
Ray, delicious.
Thank you so much for coming into the kitchen, teaching us here. If you ever need your car fixed, just give me a call.
Will do. It was a lot of fun.
Here now is resident chef Kathy Gunst and Ray Maliazzi of NPR's Car Talk for Ray's, actually his grandmother's recipe. What was your grandmother's name?
My grandmother's name was Eugenia Camelio, and she came here as a newlywed and brought all her recipes along. None of them were written down. I don't think she wrote.
Well, they're going to be written down now.
Go
to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks. Information on the web at MathWorks.